It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Come January, Republicans on Capitol Hill will achieve what's known as a governing trifecta.
Taking control of the executive branch of the president, combined with GOP majorities in both the House and the Senate.
Tax policy will be a big issue for the new Congress, with some cuts set to expire at the end of next year.
On the campaign trail, President-elect Donald Trump proposed a wide array of tax breaks, from removing federal income taxes on Social Security to not taxing things like tips or overtime.
To talk tax policy and Democratic priorities going into the new Congress, we're joined by Democratic Representative Gwen Moore. She represents parts of the Milwaukee metro region and was reelected in the general election. Representative Moore, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How do you plan to advance Democratic initiatives, Democratic priorities in this new Congress under a unified government for Republicans? What will be your strategy?
Well, I'll tell you, it really is a very tough environment, Kate. And we knew, of course, that taxes were going to be on the table no matter what the configuration of Congress and the presidency would be. You know, we're going to take advantage, number one, of the fact that this is unlike what Republicans proclaimed this to be a mandate. It is not a mandate. The margin, I think, in both the Senate and particularly in the House is very, very thin. So I think that they're going to find that they're going to have to cooperate with us. There's a lot of bullying, we think, that's going to come from the top, from the president. And so we'll see the extent to which Republicans adhere to that bullying. But what we do know is that arithmetic is just arithmetic. The Republicans have proclaimed that they want to extend the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, the 2017 taxes, which already cost $1 to $2 trillion, and expanding them fully would cost $4.6 trillion. We heard testimony yesterday in the Joint Economic Committee, which I'm also a member of, where they want to have a budget neutral outcome, which means that they'd have to pay for those $4.7 trillion in tax cuts. When we asked Dr. Hope Zekin, he's the former CBO director under Republicans, what he would do, he didn't say, of course, what Republicans would do, but he immediately went to the notion that we'd have to cut spending. I couldn't believe how fast, Kate, he started talking about Social Security and Medicare. What we have heard Democrats talk about in particular is changing Medicaid, which, of course, right now it's a dirty word, but it's an entitlement. Anyone who's eligible for it can receive it. So if you're in a nursing home, or if you're in the intensive care unit and you're 75 years old and you're laying there on your deathbed, spending lots and lots and lots of Medicaid dollars, what when you think of them block granting it, Kate, just think chopping block. They're talking about block granting Medicaid, which means that any other people who would ordinarily be eligible for Medicaid will find themselves unable to get that care because it's being consumed by, our seniors, people in nursing homes, by people who, of course, are eligible, but it really would block younger people, kids, families, other people from receiving it.
So you see that as a target for paying for additional tax cuts. I do want to touch down here on Social Security. Trump has proposed eliminating federal income tax on Social Security. Forbes estimating this could save retirees more than $135 billion a year. Is a policy like this viable?
Hey, you know, everybody likes a free lunch. And what we have found out that there is no such free lunch. I mean, Social Security is paid for by our payroll tax. And so, I can remember my 14-year-old daughter screaming and crying about paying FICA And now she's 55, and she's glad that she's paid into FICA, because that is where she will be able to receive Social Security at some point. And so it's a feel-good, you know, something like Trump signing the checks that he sent out. It's a feel-good thing, but it really undermines Social Security, and it's a really bad, bad idea.
So if these types of tax cuts go through, and perhaps we haven't talked about it, but drive up further the national debt, could they also result, though, in significant economic growth? And wouldn't that be a net positive?
Well, you know, former chair of the Ways and Means Committee, Kevin Brady, spoke with the Joint Economic Committee, on which I served yesterday, and he talked about growth, 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 growth. And of course, corporations have benefited from having their tax rates reduced from what was that 35-36% down to 21%. Of course, that incentivizes companies to make investments and so forth. But again, Dr. Douglas Holtz-Eakin, former CBO director under Republicans, said that growth is coming, but that growth is not trickling down, which is why you hear people, Kate, complaining about the cost of everything. Over half of Americans say that they are feeling economic strain. It was one of the reasons people have given at exit polls of why they voted for Trump, because they're feeling economically challenged in rent and in prices. So we gave these tax cuts to these corporations, and while it provided growth, other than that first, you know, 28 bucks we gave to people right after the tax cuts, they didn't, you know, these corporations did stock buybacks. They did not. It did not trickle down. It did not increase wages. It did not lower prices.
I want to pause right there as we talk about Democratic priorities in a Congress under full Republican control with Gwen Moore, Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, member of the Tax Writing House and House Ways and Means Committee. Representative Moore, I want to turn our attention now to child tax credits. You're one of three members on Ways and Means that voted against largely bipartisan tax legislation earlier this year. You said it was because the legislation didn't do enough to expand the child tax credit. What might it do under a Trump administration?
Well, I can tell you, a former Chair Brady said that we ought to have work requirements. And of course, there are 19 million. When we talked about we reduced poverty in families, cut it by half, it was because we provided the child tax credit with no strings attached. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to provide the tax credits and to base it on how much money a parent makes. And so I'm good with providing the child tax credit to those who are not struggling day to day, because kids cost money. I raised three of them. I mean, it costs money to raise kids, but you don't do it by cutting out the poorest of the poor and only providing it to people who are already employed. It's supposed to be called a child tax credit. Kids don't work, Kate. And so what is the point in having a work requirement? It's not only that, but it's a work requirement for Medicaid, a work requirement for SNAP. And what we have found is that these do not create true work incentives. It forces people into the low-wage workforce. And you know, it doesn't really create pathways to long-term employment and getting out of poverty. It just jerks people around, and mostly it denies them benefits to which they would otherwise certainly be entitled.
Representative Moore, let's turn our attention now to nominations. Earlier this week, President-elect Trump nominates former Wisconsin Representative Sean Duffy for Secretary of Transportation. You served alongside Duffy in the House for years until his departure from Congress in 2019. What do you make of this particular pick?
Well, just let me say, I know Mr. Duffy well, and you know we sparred considerably, but he has absolutely no credentials for this position. I mean, I guess he drives a car or a van, but he doesn't. I was stunned to hear him surface, and I think you know, he looks good on TV. I think that that is one of the things we know Donald Trump admires, people's television presence. But other than that, I, like many other people, are scratching our heads. You know, transportation, I think about our current transportation secretary, you know, Pete Buttigieg, and I think about all of the pieces of transportation that really could expand our economy in a way that really provides opportunities for people. You know, it's not just road building, but it's airports, it's trains, it's modernizing our system. I have no idea that he'll be up to the task.
And very quickly here, as we're almost out of time, any surprises to you in the picks so far of President-elect Trump's key positions?
Yep. Matt Gaetz, Tulsi Gabbard, who is a Russian asset, RFK Jr., from what I hear, that the CDC, folks at the Health and Human Services, they've got their resignation letters ready if he's confirmed. It seems like... Musk and Ramaswamy with
and
this
we're out of time. Representative Moore, thank you for joining us.
Oh, I had a great time. Thank you too.
Gwen Moore, Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, represents parts of the Milwaukee Metro. We've been talking about her priorities for a new Congress and tax cut proposals on the table.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, generations ago, counties ran poor farms to care for the most impoverished residents. Now a Milwaukee group is trying to give a final resting place to hundreds of people. Their hope?
To restore dignity, respect, provide closure, and just realize that these people had lives.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Before Social Security, before food stamps and other social safety net programs, Wisconsin, like other states, had institutions that took in people with no other place to go.
They were known as poor farms and intended to care for the neediest residents.
Today, counties have remnants of these poor farms with buildings, but also unmarked graves and cemeteries.
We'll hear from an organization in Milwaukee that's working to reclaim the memory and remains of poor farm residents.
But first, we have Megan Burke, a professor of history at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley, who studies poor farms in the Midwest. Her recent book is about the history of poor farms in America. Megan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So most poor farms in the state were closed by the late 1930s, but there was a time when poor farms were more common in Wisconsin and around the country. Can you talk about who is living on these properties and what role do they have in people's lives?
Sure. Poor farm populations change a little bit over time, but they generally are there to kind of serve as almost a clearinghouse for communities when people don't have anywhere else to go. So it's not uncommon to find unmarried women who are pregnant or have recently delivered a baby. It's not uncommon to find people with disabilities, sometimes physical disabilities, but cognitive disabilities. Sometimes the elderly, people who are sick. Sometimes transient populations who have been injured in that area are taken there to recuperate and sometimes just rest. And so primarily it's people who, for whatever reason, either at a sort of singular moment in time or for a longer period of time, are not able to necessarily take care of themselves or sustain themselves in their own household. And so poor farms kind of fit a sort of general population.
How much of a safety net were these poor farms, and how long did people stay?
They are often one of the only safety nets available to people. So most of the sort of support that people might have looked to is coming from the county or the town. It's very localized, which is a little different than what we might be accustomed to today. And so there are a couple of options that sometimes county governments, just as an example, might use. They might be able to provide people with direct aid. And that's particularly useful when people are able to stay in their own homes. So maybe you are out of work or sick, but the hope is you'll recuperate quickly and be able to stay in your own home and kind of stop receiving that aid at some point. And then the poor farm is for often people for whom that doesn't work for whatever reason. They're either not going to recover or something has happened that has kind of driven them out of their space. And so the poor farm provides that ability. And so for most communities, they are a very visible and a very well-known aspect of relief for folks. And sometimes there is a little bit of judgment about the people who live there. But there's often sometimes, feelings of, I don't want to say pity, but certainly some sympathy for people who might end up at the poor farm, particularly for people who are there simply because they are unwell or dealing with a disability or no longer able to take care of themselves.
Did their time at the poor farm rehabilitate them in any way? Were they better off or worse off when they left the poor farm?
Well, it's interesting. You know, so many people actually did leave the poor farm. For many people, it's a sort of blip in their life. It's a place where they received a little bit of temporary assistance that they needed, and then they move on to the next thing. And so the poor farms are usually not there as an active form of rehabilitation, perhaps the way that we would think of it today. Mm-hmm. But they certainly were a place for people sometimes, you know, who were sick or injured. They were able to be there and recover. They were able to receive health care. And so at that point, once they're better, they're able to leave, go out, find work, do whatever it is that they need to do. The same is true sometimes of younger people who needed the poor farm for a brief period of time. They might be able to, you know, keep custody of their child, leave, get a job, do something like that. And so there are people who needed that, just, you know, that moment of assistance, and the poor farm provides that, and they're able to leave and go back to, you know, whatever they had going on in their lives.
You found firsthand accounts of employees of poor farms in Wisconsin. Can you tell us what records you were able to unearth about poor farms in our state?
So there were some interesting kind of daily journal logs from Dane County in particular. So the manager, the superintendent of the poor farm, was kind of recording each and every day. Little things, not unlike a farm diary where there's weather involved, you know, things that got planted on the farm or harvested or what type of work was done on the property at that time. And so those daily entries also sometimes discussed in some ways the struggle that that superintendent might be having with the job. It was a huge job. You know, you're managing people and you're managing a farm and you're managing an institution and employees. So sometimes some of those frustrations kind of seep through the text. They often sometimes also talked about the residents, residents who might be dealing with a problem, residents who might be sick.
I thought it was interesting in your book how you said that thrift, not compassion, was the motive, you know, with these poor farms. And in Wisconsin, we have this unique system of hybrid institutions where large counties combine their poor farms with county asylums. What were the consequences of this type of system?
It is a really unique system, you know, and it's caused in no small part just because of the overwhelming demand for that type of asylum care. And it is distinct and different from what people at a poor farm needed. So people, you know, dealing with any kind of mental illness have just a wider range of needs sometimes in terms of, you know, therapeutic care or sometimes just safety and well-being. And so one of the things that seems to have happened at Wisconsin institutions who did that was the residents of the asylum side were able to do some work. many of their disabilities were emotional and not physical. And so it was viewed as one of the ways to kind of provide them with some therapy or a meaningful activity that they would be able to contribute to the farm in some way. And so sometimes one of the things that is noticeable is that the agricultural productivity of the farm actually increases a little bit, because those people are out kind of working. They might be able to expand the garden or perhaps expand the dairy operation on the farm. And so they're contributing in a way that poor farm residents are not always able to contribute in that way.
As we wrap up here, what do poor farms tell you about how social welfare, how social safety nets have changed over time in our country?
I think it's interesting to think about the differences between a very, very localized system and then a much more sort of high-level system. There's something almost intimate about providing people with care at their local community level. One of the things that's very evident from the records of poor farms, including those in Wisconsin, is that very often folks knew each other, and so they knew the circumstances which had perhaps brought someone to the poor farm, or they knew the kind of surrounding issues related to someone's need for assistance at that time. And so it certainly doesn't provide people with a lot of privacy, but it does provide a very interesting angle onto how communities kind of felt their obligation of care, how they felt like that was, you know, not just legally their obligation, but in some cases that it was the obligation of the community itself to take care of members of that community who couldn't otherwise take care of themselves.
Megan, thank you for your research. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Megan Burke is a professor of history at University of Texas Rio Grande Valley and author of a recent book about American poor farms. Now we turn to ancestors of poor farm residents and the work of the descendant community of Milwaukee County Grounds Cemeteries. This group aims to memorialize people who were buried at these cemeteries, who were often residents of poor farms, indigent, disabled, or forgotten. Judy Klimt Houston is president. Judy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thank you for asking me to join this discussion about the poor farms.
Can you tell us a brief history of these grounds and what they're like?
Sure, yes. Four cemeteries exist there, and they were utilized for about 10,000 graves of county residents. Many of these folks initially was the German immigrants, and then over time, Irish, the Polish, Italians, Greeks, Eastern European Jews. There are Native Americans that were buried there as well. And then following the Great Migration, then the Black community's presence in the cemeteries increased. So the history of all of this is kind of tough. Yeah. Cemetery 1 started beginning burials around 1852, ended about 1882. And then they started Site 2, Cemetery 2. And that actually ended up being a site of exhumations. There were about 7,200 burials there. And some pretty horrific desecrations about a century ago. So it ended in 1925 was the last burial in Site 2. And 3 years later, all of the 7,200 markers were pulled. Mm. And they had like the little brass tag on there to identify who's who, which correlated with the burial ledger. So they pulled all of those. They pulled the fence that delineated the cemetery and prepared that area for construction, which actually occurred 4 years later. They built a nurse's residence on the top of that cemetery, and pretty much in the center and then to the eastern end of that cemetery. By doing so, they destroyed about 55% of the graves and utilized that land or that landfill all around the property. Even to date, this past year, they found inadvertent discoveries of remains.
You learned you have an ancestor in these circumstances. What did you find out?
Actually, I have four relatives that were once buried in County Grounds Cemetery 2. One was my great aunt, who passed at the age of almost 2. And unfortunately, she was in the care of the county at the home for dependent children from birth to her death. And she, like many other children, passed away due to issues at that home. And a lot of vulnerable children then also suffered that same fate and ended up being buried at the cemetery, one of the cemeteries anyway.
You and your team are focusing on a group of people known as the 831. They were exhumed from the cemetery in 2013 to make room for the medical building. What is their history? What are you advocating for on their behalf?
So the 831 that were exhumed in 2013, as you mentioned, they were exhumed for the progress, the Freighters Hospital being placed there. There was a first group that was removed in 1991 for construction there as well. That group was turned over to UWM permanently for research. Now the 2013 group is made available for final disposition proposals. We propose reburial as a group, and the Wisconsin Historical Society is the administrator of the burial law, and the director awarded our community the reburial. So as one can imagine, finding a place for 831 individuals' graves is not so easy. Of course, we'd like them all in one area because that's how they were removed, was from one area. Being ecologically and financially sound, we are asking for a 3-foot grave rather than a full-size grave because as we can imagine, the remains are all skeletal at this point. And so our plan is to have them buried at Forest Home Cemetery in a very dignified, respectful manner. And based on the burial law, Freighters, as the entity that requested to disturb the grounds, is the entity who would pay for reburial. At this point, we were supposed to start with burials on November 8th, but Freighters and Milwaukee County have both appealed the director's decision, which means this goes now next to an administrative law judge who will then make the decision as to what is to occur.
There are many unmarked graves across Wisconsin from poor farms, and you've worked with researchers and genealogists and worked with public records to identify people buried at the cemetery. What is the process like to identify graves with such little information?
Really great question. So on UW-Milwaukee's end, they are doing osteology. They look at the remains and try to determine what they are seeing. Is there a trauma here? Is there, you know, something that occurred to this person versus another person? And they're also determining gender, possible if they can, the age. And for us, we're on the other end and we're looking at archival records. We're looking at coroner's inquests. We're trying to determine, did this, you know, what did something happen? Did something happen as far as like a train accident? And, you know, the coroner back then would list what had occurred to the body. So we're hopeful to work with UW-Milwaukee as far as like, we have this information, you have this information. Unfortunately, it's not going as like what we would like. But in the meantime, while we're looking through these inquests as well as death certificates, we've been able to locate veterans of the Civil War, which has been incredible, because we've been able to reestablish them to the community by applying for their VA headstone so that they're finally recognized for that service. So far, there have been 10 people, 10 soldiers that we were able to find amongst all the names of these individuals.
Judy, as we close here, how do you hope these reburials will be a source of healing for you and for other people?
Well, it provides closure. While, of course, we would love to have identification, that has not happened. That was, I guess, the number one goal of research. But we don't have that in the, whatever, how many decades of research. There are only 11 people that have been identified using osteology. So unfortunately, we don't have an identification. That's a shame. So our hope is to restore dignity, respect, provide closure, and just realize that these people had lives.
Judy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Judy Klimt Houston is president of the Descendant Community of Milwaukee County Grounds Cemeteries. It's a nonprofit group. It's supporting families whose ancestors were once buried at these cemeteries. And earlier, we spoke with history professor Megan Burke, whose recent book provides a history of poor farms and their role in America's social welfare system.
Still ahead, a project in Appleton tackles the growing problem of loneliness with trained listeners in a community living room.
When we think about who comes into community living room, it's really for everyone because we all need connection.
That's next here on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a comeback story about a special band of horses.
Thousands of Ojibwe horses once roamed in the northern United States and Canada in the early 20th century. But the rare breed almost disappeared by the late 1970s. Then recently, a descendant of the White Earth Nation rescued 6 Ojibwe horses and gave them a home in northwestern Wisconsin. WPR's Danielle Kading brings us this story about Emily Lorzel and the Humble Horse Organization, which aims to keep the rare breed alive.
I know, Mama.
White Earth Indigenous cause. Mityu or Ojibwe Anishinaabe Kwe Mityu. So that's a traditional Ojibwe protocol greeting. My name is Emily Lorzel. I founded this, and my husband and I, we both live on site, so we attend to all of the daily needs of the herd, including things like fundraising and outreach and stuff like that. But it's a volunteer-ran organization, so we don't get paid for anything that we do. All the donations go straight back for the horses. A part of our mission here at the Humble Horse is to preserve the breed and to hopefully one day repatriate them back to Anishinaabe communities.
Itchy.
In Anishinaabe culture, if you don't have a name, your ancestors can't find you, so we gave everybody Anishinaabe names. That's Nojimo, or we call her Jimmy, and that's Dini, but we call her Mama. And then there's Busweiwei, which is Echo. And then this is Nimki, who I guarantee you, once you start giving him pets, he will stalk you to the end of days, because he is like, hi, Mama. Just the friendliest. I have an Auntie Siobhan Marks and a Uncle Mark Denning. Uncle Mark actually grew up with these horses, or he grew up with ponies, these small little ponies in the forest, right? I learned about these horses from him, and he would always tell me that his dream was to see these horses back in Wisconsin, because as he was growing up with them, they eventually kind of disappeared. What we do know is there were only about four left in 1976. The last stallion was shot by a non-Indigenous researcher who thought he was a moose in the 1960s. So with only four mares left in 1976, and the Canadian government saying, these guys are a public nuisance, we're going to destroy them, four members from Fort Boyce and Lac La Croix nations got together in the middle of the night, loaded these four mares up onto a horse trailer, actually border hopped over the ice. It's called Heist Across the Ice. And they found sanctuary in a farm in Minnesota. They were able to repopulate, and they were crossbred with a Spanish Mustang that was kind of the most phenotypically similar to the breed. So all of the horses today are related to those four mares. I didn't know we had horses until I was in my early 20s. And why is it that I didn't know about these horses until I was that age? These horses were so vital to our survival. And what's cool about it is it was a consensual relationship. We didn't have to keep them penned up. They would come back every year around the winter to help us check trap lines, haul logs. There's even stories of them pawing through ice to help with ice fishing. So because they helped Anishinaabe people survive and we consider them a relative, I guess my question would be, wouldn't you help your relative survive?
WPR's Daniel Kading brought us that story on Ojibwe horses. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Last year, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy released an advisory on a public health crisis related to loneliness and isolation in the United States.
He warned of the mental, emotional, and even physical health risks that can come with loneliness.
Also last year, a program in Appleton began offering a local solution to loneliness and isolation. The Community Living Room offered pop-up listening spaces around town, providing peer support and connection for residents. Just last month, the program was finally gifted a permanent space of its own.
The goal is to boost interpersonal connection and improve mental health outcomes for participants.
Karen Iverson-Riggers is a Wisconsin-certified peer specialist, lead trainer of emotional CPR for the state of Wisconsin, and a founding worker and owner of Ebb and Flow Connections Cooperative, which facilitates this community living room project. And Sarah Kolbeck is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral medicine, director of the Division of Suicide Research and Healing in the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's the academic partner on the Community Living Room Project. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Karen, thanks for being with us.
So glad to be with you.
All right, Karen, talk us through what the Community Living Room looks like, how it works in practice.
Yeah, so Community Living Room is a project of Ebb and Flow Connections Cooperative, and it's really centered on creating connection. So this really came out of recognizing the need in community with folks feeling really lonely and isolated and wanting to create a space that breaks down a lot of the barriers that people often find when seeking support. So there's no appointments needed, no forms. You come in and we welcome you just like I'd welcome you into my living room. We have food, we have beverages, and folks there who are there to listen.
And that's the key to this. If I show up as a participant here, I'm not talking to a therapist, right, who's going to give me advice or prescriptions or cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm going to be talking to someone who's a really good listener. Do I have that right?
That's right. And all the folks who are listeners in our community living room all have their own experience with mental health, substance use, trauma, other adverse experiences. So we've been there. We talk about connection as being seen, heard, and valued just as you are, right? Without judgment, without fixing, without, oh, have you tried? Or as we often do out of our own discomfort to try to kind of silver lining something. We're just there to be present for whatever is present for that person. And sometimes we're laughing together and sometimes we're crying together. Really that gift of human to human connection.
And Karen, who do you have in mind as the participant, people who would take advantage of the service that you're providing here? What do you expect people would be coming in with?
So we say that connection is prevention. So lots of times folks don't reach out until they're really struggling. And often they make that call, right? And they're told like, oh, you have to wait 6 weeks or 3 months for an appointment or to talk to somebody. So the idea of community living room is really to be kind of on that prevention side, right? When you're first struggling or even before you might be struggling and just looking for connection. We need connection as humans. And so when we think about who comes into community living room, it's really for everyone.
Sarah, let's bring you into this. Karen just mentioned that concept, connection is prevention. Now, I know in a lot of your work, you've done work with specific at-risk groups, farmers, medical professionals, to see what works in suicide prevention. How important a part of our mental, our emotional well-being is just that simple concept of connection?
Yeah. And I guess what I will say is that really connection is the antidote to pain, right? When we are experiencing, you know, whether it's a mental health challenge or some other sort of life challenge, that social connection is the key to really improving, whether it's, you know, health outcomes or, you know, even just the situation that a person is in. We know that social connection from the suicide prevention literature and from the mental health literature is incredibly protective. So I think, you know, with the community living room piece offering that connection sort of in the community in a very accessible way, it's really doing a lot in terms of that upstream prevention for, you know, whether, again, it's a mental health challenge or even suicide.
Karen, you've been doing these living rooms as pop-ups since last year. I understand now it's got its own space in downtown Appleton. I'm really curious how you set the stage, right? How do you make this a setting where people feel comfortable maybe talking to a stranger about something that they're not comfortable talking even to their own friends and loved ones with? How do you make that a good space for that to happen?
Yeah, that's real. And through our experience in doing pop-ups in community, sometimes folks will like point blank say to us, why are you here? What are you doing? And so we'll invite into the space, we'll explain, right? We're just here to listen. And often that shows up, like we don't force any connection. We are just present. And so when you come into our space in downtown Appleton, we've got couches and a rug and lamps and there's food on the table and there's coffee and there's tea and we have warm cookies because warm cookies in the living room, right? And so really that breaking down the barrier of saying that there's really not an expectation of how you have to be here. We're just here to be present with you.
We are talking about the Community Living Room Project. Karen Iverson-Riggers is with us, a founding and worker and owner of Ebb and Flow Connections Cooperative. They facilitate this project. Sarah Kolbeck also with us, academic partner on the project, director of the Division of Suicide Research and Healing at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Let's, Karen, talk about listening. And people might hear listening and think, that's easy. We listen all the time. I've learned slowly in my personal professional life that listening is a real skill. Can you talk about the kind of training that goes in for the listeners in this project?
Oh, you absolutely put it right, right? We get a lot of training on writing and speaking and reading, and we receive very little facilitation on what it means to really listen. So we have a training that's called emotional CPR or ECPR. So just like you take CPR for your physical heart, ECPR is for supporting folks in emotional distress or crisis.
And so it really focuses on a couple of things. One is centering ourselves, like being fully present in the moment, and how do we do that, and connecting with ourselves. And then also thinking about, in listening, how do we connect at the level of emotion? How do we connect with saying, oh, I can identify a time in my life when I felt that way. I can really feel with you. So you might describe it as listening in empathy.
Sarah, you've been through the ECPR training, the emotional CPR training, I understand. What kind of things did you take away from that?
Yeah, it's interesting because as the academic partner on this project, I really wanted to attend the ECPR training just to sort of get a feel for what the training is about, the types of things that are taught as part of the training. And so I went in very much with that academic partner kind of hat on. And I found myself very quickly sort of taking that hat off and becoming an active participant, because it really is about making those very, very human connections. And I think one of the things that I learned is, if you have had human experiences, if you've experienced grief or loss or sadness or loneliness, you have all of the training and expertise that you need to do this listening. And so it really is about sort of that practice then of that really intentional listening with empathy that Karen mentioned.
Karen, it seems to me there's some lessons here for our everyday lives, not just for the listeners at the community living rooms. Like, I'll speak for myself. I've been in that situation. Somebody shares a problem and I want to go right to, well, have you tried blank? Or, hey, things are going to work out okay. How do we get past those sort of responses we go to and give the person what they actually want and need?
Well, those are very human responses, right?
I hope so.
When we care deeply about other people, right, we don't want to see them in pain. Or we see that in community, even somebody we don't know, right? We don't want to see them in pain. And so lots of times out of our own discomfort, we go to, like, let me fix it, or let me tell you it's okay, like, or all of those kind of things. And there's something so powerful about just witnessing pain, just being a witness, right? To say, like, I see you, and that sounds really hard. Or I really don't have any words. I'm just so glad you told me. And often that kind of listening without, like, fixing, it can be so powerful. We say in our work that pain witnessed is pain transformed. It doesn't fundamentally change anything about what that person is going through, but something fundamentally shifts when we really feel witnessed right where we are.
Karen, this is in Appleton. We're on the radio statewide. Suppose somebody out there is listening thinking, hey, yeah, we need this in our community. What would you say to them to help them steal your idea?
Yes, we would love to see community living room everywhere and accessible for folks. And so one of the pieces is emotional CPR training that we do. We offer that both in person and virtually. So that's accessible to anyone throughout the state. And that's a great way to build some understanding about what this project really means and how we listen. And so we have folks that are in Madison. We have folks that are in Menominee. We have folks in the kind of Lakeshore region, Manitowoc, Sheboygan. We have folks in Green Bay who are all working to build community living room in those communities. So it's really exciting to see this project grow, expand, and I would love to see this everywhere. So everyone has a space to connect.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Karen Iverson-Riggers is a founding worker and owner of Ebb and Flow Connections Cooperative in Appleton. Sarah Kolbeck is director of the Division of Suicide Research and Healing at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We talked to them about Appleton's community living room, a new space for interpersonal connection. Yesterday, we got some Thanksgiving advice on how to cook turkey, and we invited you to share your favorites and your cooking advice.
A listener named Michelle emails, "Hi, I have a leg bone to pick about brining turkey. Most commercially sold birds are already brined, injected with broth or salt solution, ready to cook. And the package will say if the bird is brined already, so read the label," Michelle says. "A natural or uninjected bird straight from the farm, that will need salt."
Michelle goes on, "I've done both kinds of bird. Didn't notice a difference between my brining or pre-injection. I've also just salted the bird inside and out the day before, and guess what? Pretty much the same. Cooked to the right temp, and you'll gobble it up. Thanks for giving me a chance to pepper you with Thanksgiving puns.
Thanks for the advice and the puns, Michelle. How about you? Share your favorite Thanksgiving foods, your cooking advice. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.